Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on raconteursnews.com. That, of course, was Deep Purple and Burn, because I suspect, as many more people are beginning to suspect, that we are in fact being burned. Before that, Party Hard, which is something that I think hopefully you'll want to feel like doing after listening to tonight's show, because we're going to be getting deep down and dirty, getting into the grit of insurance, contract and community charge or council tax or whatever it is that we want to call it. Because these seem to be challenges that are rising for many, many people. And it gives me really great pleasure to welcome for the first time to Dr. Brock's radio show, Roger Walker. Roger, thanks so much for making time for coming and joining us, mate. I really do appreciate it.
It's not a problem. I've spoken to you over the years a number of times by accident in various places. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, man.
Well, it's brilliant, because I think of the many shows we've done over the years, some of them have actually been of some practical use. And I think that really some of the material we're going to be talking about tonight especially falls into that category, because as we know, everything we deal with in the world outside the front door is effectively a matter of contract, isn't it?
Indeed, law, whatever its jurisdiction, is about relationship and whether one exists or not. Put it simply, most people know that common law are things that would be considered acts of inhumanity. Somebody beating the crap out of somebody else for whatever reason, somebody destroying somebody's property or stealing it. Those are imprisonable offences, they're acts of inhumanity, and it's why the police were invented, was to protect the rest of us from the worst amongst us. They seem to be siding with the other group now. In statutory law, relationship is about nothing other than paperwork and money. There's no criminal law in statutory law, it's just Roman administrative law. A contract either exists or it doesn't, therefore a relationship exists or it doesn't. Party A can come crashing through your door onto Party B if they have a piece of paper that shows that they are empowered to do so in their relationship with you. If they don't have that piece of paper and they come through that door, you do them for everything you can think of.
And it's certainly the impression we get from them, isn't it, that they do in fact have some kind of authority under which they're acting. That's what their letters appear to imply anyway.
That's always the way, but and what it's worth mentioning, and this may shock some people, authority is a concept, it's not real. And the jurisdiction is imposed by assumption that you are the entitled person and they deal with you as such. Now, you can only be the entitled person if you have indeed contracted in some way to enter into a relationship in statutory jurisdiction with a title, Mr., Mrs., Miss., Doctor., Secretary of State for something, professor, something. They're all titles. The entitled person is the title in front of your name. That's all. But they'd have to have a piece of paper where you've signed within that jurisdiction to say you made that relationship within that jurisdiction.
Okay, so we've got to, they've got to establish that they've got some actual relationship with you before they can act on you in any way at all. That's what we're saying,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely, that's it. And what you're looking for is you're chasing a paper trail. It's all paperwork and numbers. That's all it's about, admin. It's just paperwork and money. So whichever, if we're talking about statutory law and things like insurance, council tax, tax in general, somebody somewhere has to prove that there is a relationship where you, a man or woman in common law, entered into a contract in statutory law by declaring yourself as the entitled person entering the contract in that jurisdiction, not as a man or woman. So you sign away saying you are Mr. So-and-so and you're acting in that jurisdiction. Simplest one would be, you give me so much a month and I'll provide you with the internet. The contract comes through the post, people are buying the internet, they sign it, they don't read it, they never do diligence and they send it away again. Now we have a relationship. There's a bit of paper that proves that we'd provide you with the internet if you paid us. If the individual doesn't pay, the company has the right to take them to court. You've reneged on your contract in that jurisdiction. They gave you the internet, you didn't pay for it. And likewise, the other way round. If you don't get the internet and you paid for it, they owe you.
And I guess that's the same as things used to be, say, down your local hardware store. If you got them to deliver a load of stuff and you signed for having it delivered, then that's taking on the obligation to pay and all that kind of stuff.
Well, no, if you signed to say the obligation that they would deliver it and they deliver it, that's fine. If you signed to say they'd deliver it and they didn't, you have a case against them. They've broken the contract. They said they would deliver it.
Mm. No, I meant if they, you know, they come and drop a load of stuff off in your drive and you sign a piece of paper to say, yeah, I've got all of that. Thank you very much.
Oh, yes, that's it.
That's it.
Well, you'd sign for, if you think most things are like that, they hand you a bit of something to sign, say, we've just delivered this, can you sign here? And it's usually electronic now, you know, one of those styluses, and you scrawl your marker on, and that's basically closed the deal. It's all done. I've agreed, I've got them.
And basically the deal with the internet suppliers just like that, but you're getting an internet service instead of somebody dropping off a load of stuff that you want to pay them for.
Yeah, but ultimately, the internet actually only interacts with the real world, so you will get something dropped off if you bought something. They won't send it down the internet. No. So you will have a bit of paper arriving somewhere.
But saying, under those circumstances, we only really require one signature, don't we? And that's the way most of the contracts we're dealing with work. But it's not true of all of them, is it?
Correct. There are four things in law that must be signed by both parties, and it's because of the nature of what's being sold. Mortgage is one. Land is another. Contracts of guarantee, those things where you go to Currys and they say, oh, do you want to take out a 5-year cover? They will be triplicated. Both parties will sign. You'll get the top copy. The individual who sold it to you will get a copy for her or his bonus. And the other copy goes to the office of the company they're working for. And the last thing that has to be signed by both parties is insurance. And you wouldn't believe what's happening in this country with regards to insurance.
Well, that's, I think, that's why I'd like to base the discussion we're going to have around insurance, because not only we, but a lot of people we know appear to be having a bit of an experience with their insurers at the moment, but also because it'll allow us to give concrete examples of what would otherwise be quite airy ideas that we're going to be talking about.
I only ever talk about real-world examples. Theories are nice, you know, but they don't do anything until you've actually run the theory as an experiment to prove that it works or not.
When we're dealing with things that we need to apply, I think we need to hear how they've been applied in the past. So let's kick off with the story that we were telling each other when we talked over the phone earlier on. You go down an insurance broker and say, I want some motor insurance, and they say, that's totally cool. Give us £240 and we'll sort it out. And so they take the £240 as a check, it clears, and somebody delivers to you an insurance policy. It kind of arrives through the post in this particular occasion. And then several days after you actually receive the insurance policy, you get an unsigned letter which requests that you supply, various, what they claim to be basically identity checks, but it looks to me more like a compliance check. Suddenly you get a letter which is not signed by anybody, which requires you, or requests you actually is the word used, to send in a license and a logbook, and also to provide your insurer with what they call your online DVLA codes. And in order to share those DVLA codes with said insurer, you have to surrender your national insurance number. So let's just take it up to that point. You got any comment to make on that as a way of doing, providing service to a customer? Let's put it that way, shall we?
Right. Let's go backwards a step and actually define what a contract is and how it comes about. It's the thing that builds the relationship. So what happens is you go hunting around for insurance and somebody says, yeah, go on, we'll do it for X. What you then say is, OK, send me your terms and conditions for my due diligence. You then read through them. Am I getting what I really want for the X that I might be paying once I close this contract? You might look at it and think, well, it's pretty good, but can we just change something here and something there? Then you're negotiating. So the first three stages are somebody offers you a contract. You do due diligence and read what it is you're buying. And then if you don't like it, you can go into negotiation if that's possible. If the negotiations are successful, you then close the contract. Now, you might close the contract after due diligence because you look at it and think there's no way I'm getting involved in this. You can piss off. So there's no need to negotiate, but you have to have those four steps. So in order, the insurance company would send out a contract. You'd consider it and say, OK, yeah, I'm happy that you're going to cover this, that and the other. And you're going to charge me, I don't know, 65 quid a month, 85, 100 pounds a month, an amount a month. They then go, OK, that's fine. Can you send us money in some form or another? And you agree with them and record the fact that you do, if it's a phone call, record it, that they're going to send two contracts that their party has signed to you. You've agreed that you're going to do business. You sign both of them. You keep one and you give the other one back. And that has to happen in insurance because funny things can happen if it doesn't. Now you're insured. Once the money's changed hands and the contract's in your hand, they can't then start looking at more terms and conditions because the business is done. We're finished. You offered me a contract. I considered it. We negotiated it. We agreed on terms and conditions of our relationship, and we closed on it by you giving me the contract and me giving you the money. You can't now change the terms and conditions for the time period that that contract is in operation, which is usually a year.
Yeah.
That's how it should. That's how all contracts should work in insurance in particular.
And how's it actually working, do we think?
There's a lot going on. Would you believe I can state this even if huge legal departments are listening in, because I've still got all the evidence to this day, because I'm a great archivist. When you do law and you win or lose, keep your records, know what you've done from your mistakes. I chased an insurance company on behalf of somebody who had taken money off a guy because he missed a payment, and they decided they wanted the rest of the payment, but he could of the contract. He was paying monthly and he couldn't afford it. And they hid a load of money and then terminated the contract a month later. I then chased for finding out what on earth went on. So what's the first thing you asked for? Well, hang on, I call this money parting here, so there must be a contract. Right, notice of discovery. And you address it to the person who's liable or to the top bunny in the company if you don't know who is. And I provide that individual with the right to delegate it to who's liable. You're basically saying, hang on, this has all gone pear-shaped. Send me a copy of the contract that we both signed that show that I was insured. Nothing turned up. Now, it gets better. Under insurance, they have to take out a credit agreement under the 1974 Consumer Credit Act. And so we sent notice of discovery to an individual again who was liable for a copy of that contract under the 1974 Consumer Credit Act and spent them £1, as we're entitled to do so. Nothing turned up. We then sent a notice of discovery for any papers of authorization that had allowed said company to take money from the bank account of the entitled person, Mr. John Smith. Nothing turned up. That company is Admiral. The repeated doing of that is not fraud. It's fraudulent practice. In other words, they're running a scam. And if you look at Admiral's history, they blossomed into a billion-dollar insurance company from almost nothing in no time.
Actually, the same thing applies to one of the lot that we're looking at. We've just realised that the second insurance company involved in this kind of rather convoluted story is registered in Belgium, has only been there for about 66 years and is already worth like 80 billion or something.
Yeah. How do they do that? How does somebody start a company and become a billionaire of epic proportions in that time?
By charging people a shed load of money and not providing any service, I would guess that probably helps at least.
Yeah, let me explain why the contracts should be the way they are, because this is what happens. You have a, let's say, a nice car and you're involved in a smash. And it's actually your fault. So the insurance company, it's your fault. You go to the insurance company and say, I've had this accident. It has been my fault. I am taking liability. And that means I'm going to pay for the mistakes, the cock-ups, and anything else has to be repaired. But, of course, the insurance company have sold you liability. So they take the hit for you. That's why you're buying it. They pick up the tab for any damages. Now,
God, hang on. Is that what they're supposed to do?
Yes. It gets better. When you go to the courtroom, they may beforehand ask you if you've got a copy of the contract that they could send, that you could send to them, because they appear to have lost theirs. If you haven't got a copy of that contract to send them, guess what happens in the courtroom? There is the proof that there is no relationship between the insurance company and the entitled person who paid for it, because there's no contract to prove the relationship exists. So what do the judges do? The insurance companies agree to give them the money back they've paid for what they never got. The insurance company walk out of the room with a break even. You've still got a buggered car. When you pay for car insurance, make sure you get two contracts signed by somebody taking liability from their side. You then take the liability from yours by signing both. You keep one, they get one. The end. But that's how it should work.
My guess is that there's hardly anybody in UK PLC that has that kind of insurance, because I don't suppose many people have asked to see the contract. I don't suppose many people read the terms and conditions.
Yeah, most people don't understand contract law. It's actually breathtakingly simple. If you just stood back from it for a minute, you could run your life much better than you did. And we'll deal with that in the second half with council tax, because that's imposition of contract through statutory article rather than you voluntarily paying somebody for a service or a good with a contract attached to that.
Okay, I noticed that in those notices, rather than ask a lot of questions in one, you establish one thing at a time, starting with the big one first. Is that a standard approach?
Yes, of course, because we're back to relationship. If somebody has is saying they are entitled to money off you, or they're throwing letters at you saying you owe, then there must be a contract that shows that the other party has the right of claim of that money within the contract. If the contract doesn't exist, there is no relationship. In other words, because we're in dealing with administrative law, in the courtroom, if you don't produce that contract, that's it. We're done.
Okay, so... So we know that corporations of all sorts, from judges, right, from courts right the way down to, you know, what we might normally consider to be a commercial entity, have a tendency to ignore the things that we send to them. Are there particular things we need to know about this notice of discovery that make it absolutely necessary for them to look at it?
Bingo, you've hit the nail on the head. A, the first thing is try and send it to the right person. Now, it's very difficult to find out who's liable. So in an insurance situation, go for the guy who's right at the top. I've done this historically. They usually send their lawyers going, this isn't the droid you're looking for. And they try and divert the tactic and away from who you're talking to. If you get sucked in by that, more fool you. Keep writing to the top man until he delegates somebody to take liability for it. Now, when you write a notice, the ingredients are your address, top right-hand side, with the postcode in brackets. So it's for information only, not as a commercial entity. Their address, left-hand side, and any numbers to do with anything, reference numbers, account numbers, all that. It's all about paperwork, that's all. Put that there. And then dear, and define them into existence as the entitled person. Dear Mr. Joe Bloggs. Then underneath, a notice of discovery underlined in the middle of the page, bold and in capitals. You start from under there. I, Roger Walker, a man under common law, require of you, Mr. Joe Bloggs, acting in the capacity of chief executive officer for an insurance company, send me within the next 14 days of this notice a copy of the contract you say exists that makes the entitled person, Mr. Roger Walker, liable for payment. I look forward to your reply. Yours sincerely. At the bottom, put your own name in type and two witnesses, but you can just put witness one and witness two. You sign it, they sign it. Under those names, type all rights reserved by all the above named, not signed. Send that off, and he or she or anyone should know that that is the legal document. You're asking for a very simple thing to prove there's a relationship between two defined parties. One, a man looking for a contract where he entered into statutory jurisdiction as the entitled person with another party commercially. Does that make sense?
It makes lots of sense to me. Right. And what's the signature, just so that in case we've got any beginners and stuff, and because you can't hear the basics repeated often enough, what are you doing? You were quite clear about the way you were naming the individual that was sending the letter and to whom you were sending it. What's the significance of the difference in forms there?
Right. Never write to dear sir or madam. They don't exist. They're a concept. They're not a reality. You want to write to somebody who's acting in the capacity of a statutory entitled person and in a capacity for a commercial organisation. So it's Joe Bloggs acting in the capacity of CEO for an insurance company, generically. Or it might be, let's have a think. Yeah, we'll touch on council tax now. You could be asking your Section 151 officer for the instrument that created the liability for the entitled person. And if that instrument doesn't exist, there's no relationship, there's no debt owed. So you're always looking for paperwork. Define your opponent into existence in statutory law, because by definition they are in it anyway, and you're going to impose statutory regulations upon them.
Mm-hmm. And the important thing there is that they're trying to impose statutory regulations on you, which is a wholly different thing, isn't it?
Yes, that's a completely different kettle of fish. We'll deal with that later. Let's go back to the notice, because we've started a conversation. So suppose nothing comes back in this 14 days you've asked for this instrument. You then have to default. When you start a legal conversation, you have to close it down as well. So the default document should be notice of default and mutual understanding. Now, in law, what that means is we both agree that the relationship, as I describe it, is as it is. So your default document is set your address top right, their address below on the left, all the relevant numbers, notice of default, and mutual understanding. I, Roger Walker, a man under common law, sent you Mr. So-and-so, so-and-so, acting as chief executive officer for an insurance company, a notice of discovery 14 days ago. You have consequently failed to respond to that notice, and I take it, therefore, that we now have a mutual understanding that there is no contract of association between insurance company as party A and the entitled person as party B. You have 14 days to contest this default document, and you wait. After 14 days, it becomes a legal fact if they don't prove it isn't.
And let's face it, in most people who pulled this, who did this kind of thing, would get that kind of result, because in these internet days, people just aren't signing anything.
Correct. Now, when you get bits of paper coming in through the door, you can have great fun with them if you can lose the fear aspect of looking at Party B as this huge monolithic thing that you couldn't beat. You are David. Don't worry about Goliath. They are just another party in law. Think of them as one thing and you're one thing. So he takes the fear out of it. You can get letters coming back going, dear sir or madam. Okay. For a bit of fun, respond. You sent a letter to my address on this date, addressed to dear sir or madam. Unfortunately, there's nobody of that name here. Yours sincerely, goodbye. Now, you can also look at documents and say, what should be there that's missing? That's what people miss. You've got to have a named individual in type with a signature above it, because they have to authorize the document into existence and say, I wrote this. If it's an action against you, they are taking liability if that action is incorrect and they are not actually eligible to exercise that action. Now, if there's no signature and no name, what you're holding on to is toilet paper. It isn't admissible in any court of law because nobody in statutory law has written it.
Okay, so not only does nobody have an insurance policy because nobody's got a bilaterally signed contract, which is
correct,
crucial to make it exist, but also nobody, as far as I can see, none of the letters that are coming through with regard to the story that we started with have got any signatures on them at all. Not a one.
No, so that's right. I have a friend of mine who did, when we discovered this some years ago, and I told the Admiral story, he bought insurance and he got into the idea. He learned very quickly what it was all about. He's quite a bright bunny. And they came to him, they rang him up, I think it was about 14 days after he'd agreed to take the policy out. And they said, we haven't received payment. And he said, well, I haven't received two copies of the contract with signatures on from your party taking liability for me to sign and send one back. And they went, oh, hang on a minute. All went quiet. And they went, it's okay. 7 days later, he got said two contracts signed by the other side, taking liability, because that's what they're selling. We'll take the hit for you if you fuck it up. And he signed both, kept one, sent one back. And he's the only one I know who's actually insured.
So do we think that if everybody asked for these things, that that's the way it would start working again? Is it simply a matter of a failure on our part to require them to send us the documents that they need to send us? Do you think they'd do it?
Yeah, that's what the basic problem is. Where, I mean, it dawned on me some years ago with the sort of law swirling around. I thought, how come I know so little about it? You know, and yet it's all over the place. And that's what got me into it. And the point is, it's not knowing what has to be there to make it legitimate. And I stress the word, because obviously it's legitimate in statutory law. So they've got to have signatures, got to have names. It's got to be put up in a certain way. It's got to say certain things. And it's all got to tie up in paperwork. Otherwise, it's garbage. It means nothing. So what you're getting is government departments sending out, say, the DWP sending out loads of letters, no names on, no signatures, nobody taking liability. They're meaningless, but they'll act on them as if they weren't meaningless.
So what does that mean for us? I mean, at what point does it become evident, shall we say? At what point does the meaninglessness actually materialise in a useful form for us?
Their meaninglessness, it depends on the situation. You can throw back at them. I say with the DWP, I did something a while ago that's quite interesting. In a DWP tribunal, we went in and had an adjournment. The adjournment wasn't our fault. And we'd got... what was it now, witness summonses for the members of the DWP who had been involved in this action to appear in the courtroom. But what we've done is we got the witness summonses through the county court, which is above the tribunal. It's practice direction. Oh, Christ, I can't remember. I've got it here somewhere. And what you do is you go to a higher court for your witness summonses to get the DWP there, because it means the lower court, if they don't turn up, you can ask them to issue arrest warrants, given that they should have turned up and they're now committing a criminal offence. The judge in that tribunal cannot overturn those arrest warrants because they've come from a higher court. He'd be in contempt of court.
Cut. And is it easy
so
to get
you can outmaneuver them. You can outmaneuver the judiciary and they don't like it.
Is that an easy move to make, to go to that higher court to get these warrants?
Piece of piss. It's practice direction 34B2 onwards. That's what it is. Practice direction 34B2 onwards. It actually states how you can do that. That a subordinate court that doesn't have the power to raise witnesses can ask a higher court to do it, or indeed the litigant can.
Then what happened?
Then what happened is that after the adjournment, we went back into this tribunal, and the judge said, I'm afraid the witness summonses don't have any validity. And I just immediately said, yes, they do. They are completely valid. Your colleague agreed. It was a fire alarm that caused the adjournment. It was not of our causing. We've also contacted your colleague judge to make sure that they were still valid and didn't need reissuing. Well done, Judge. So in your opening statement, you've committed perjury. Do you want to write a warrant for your arrest because you're now due a year in prison? And that's not a joke. That's exactly what I said to him.
And how did he respond to that?
Jaw dropped. The guy to the right of him looked like he was about to crap his underwear. His face was a picture, and he had a doctor that never said a word on the other side. He went on again, we need to talk about the medical side of this case. We said, we don't need to talk about anything. So I threw the next one at him. I said, Party B is here in the courtroom. Party A has a representative. That's hearsay. This is an appeal. Party B wins by default. This is Roman administrative law we're exercising here, isn't it, Judge? I'll make it really easy and save the court some time. They immediately called for an adjournment, because what they do is regroup and think, what the fuck are we going to do about this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
they don't like it up in Mr. Mannering.
So they retired behind closed doors to get themselves in a bit of a huddle and presumably write up some sort of trust or something. What did they come back with?
They came back with an adjournment and that it would take an entire day for the case. And I'm just sitting there looking at the judge going, you've really lost it, haven't you? Say, Judge, because I knew we hadn't won anything on the day, I said, Judge, you're better off dealing with people like me, those who pick up a pen. Because when those who prefer the sword find out, you're all going to be slaughtered. And I just got up and left.
How did that pan out?
I didn't go to the second case for issues I won't go into because it's not relevant, and the individual didn't win.
Right. And what about the unsigned bits of paper that they're sending through the door?
Oh, right. That was good. In the courtroom, I even said to the judge that if you looked at the bundle, now the bundle is the communications that took place. That must be in chronological order, paginated and separated with a divider at every 100 pages. I said to the judge, the DWP have signed none of their documents. The only admissible document they've got is from a manager saying that the decision maker had the right to make the decision. We still don't know who that individual is because nobody's standing up as the decision maker. And the only valid paperwork in that bundle is ours because it's all authorised and witnessed. In other words, we finished this conversation outside the courtroom. The only reason we're here is for you to prove to our opponent that we have won. That's what a court's for. Settling contract disputes.
And that's what we're talking about here, isn't it? It's about winning the argument and the paperwork before you actually go and take it in there. And just a swift point on that last one, none of those bits of paper were signed. The only bit of paper was signed was signed by somebody you couldn't identify, so it didn't have the printed name underneath it. So in effect, all of it was void.
Correct, but you know, it's laughable. The system is falling apart and they're breaking the law on a daily basis. They are doing the business, the judges, for the system. That's what's going on.
Mm.
I've had the hot potato syndrome. I don't know whether anyone's had this. If you have a case that bounces through courtrooms, you end up becoming like pass the parcel, but no judge wants to be left holding you because they realise you can actually play the game and they don't want to try and win for the other side for fear of their own career. I've had trials turned into courts of direction. That's happened at county courts, where the judge who was supposed to make a decision, who was supposed to be the trial day, panicked and crapped himself and turned it into a court of direction, wanting both parties to submit more evidence so he didn't have to make the decision.
And what was the long-term result of turning it into a court of direction?
The long-term result is we got direction to submit a skeleton argument, and I said, that's no problem at all, I can give you the skeleton argument now, the other side don't have a contract. That's my entire argument, Judge. All I want to see is a bit of paper that proves that my client is liable to the other side. Can you get them to show me that now? And he went, well, no, I think we need to. And they, in other words, you're closing them down on making a decision. And that's a motion, by the way. You'll hear it in the House of Commons. When you want the court to do something, you have to motion them. Motion, motion, motion. Judge, give this person her car back in 42 days, pay her expenses in 24, and we'll call it a day. In other words, you're saying, make a decision now. I want you to make a decision now. The word motion means make a decision, based on what I'm saying now. So, in fact, the guy kicked it into touch. We went to another court and met a typical psychopathic judge. And you can spot them, because what they do, when they realise they're losing, they throw tantrums like eight-year-old children, because, of course, violence is always the last resort of the selfish and retarded. What else have they got left if you're beating them at their own game? They think they can break the rules with impunity. He basically threw half the evidence away at the start of the court. We got a charge against them of being in breach of a court order, because in one of the first courts, they were supposed to produce documents and they failed to do so. So on the second one, we said, where are these documents? They're in breach of a court order. So we were nailing them for everything they were doing wrong. But the judges will lean heavily if you've got barristers in front of you, because they're part of the same club. I've even proved a barrister was a liar in a courtroom in front of a judge.
So how do you deal with that? Because when push comes to shove, this is the kind of thing that this method is likely to end up with. You have to be prepared to go and actually present your own case, don't you? So
practice. The best thing to do, what I started doing, was to go to magistrates' courts, because anybody can go in and just sit in there. You need to have a shape of law and think, okay, what's in the courtroom? What's going on here? Let's tell them. Whether it's a statutory court or a county court, whether it's a magistrate's court or a county court or otherwise, if it's under statutory jurisdiction, the judge isn't actually the highest party in the room. The clerk is. The clerk is liable. We're back to that word again. In other words, if something goes wrong, he has to cough up for it. The judge isn't liable, so you can get the clerk to control the judge. And one of the best ways of doing that is to get a £50,000 lien made up by a notary and leave the name off. When you get the name of the clerk on the day, if he starts fucking about, you write it in and hand it to him and say, you will keep this administrator in order. Because under administrative law, judges are acting in the capacity of administrators. It's just paperwork. But by being judges, it makes it look awesome and big and the rest of it. They're just doing paperwork. Think of them as office people, stationary people, people who move paperwork around.
Rubber-stamping clowns is what Guy Taylor calls them.
Well, yeah, they are. I've met some that have really exploded. I mean, I met a woman who should be in an institution. Control freak doesn't really quite sum it up. And she actually found against us, even though the other party hadn't turned up. I mean, there's so many breaches of God knows what in that. I wrote a 3.5-page interlocutory document to the manager at Birmingham County Court to let him know that at every stage of the process, it had all gone wrong, all the staff had lied, and the judgment was a criminal judgment against the client. Because the solicitor for the bank turned up and the bank didn't. In other words, they've thrown the towel in. You've got to know that. If you go into court and the other party isn't there, you've won by default. What you've got to do is motion the court at that moment and say, since the other party is absent, I'm present, I win by default, and then announce whatever's required. The contract's not valid. I don't owe the money. There is no liability. We're done here, aren't we, Judge? Can you write that up and send it to the other party? You've got to take control and control the judge and tell them what to do at that moment.
There we go again with the contracts not valid. It's the point that we keep returning to, because it is the single point at the root of the whole thing, isn't it?
Where's the paperwork? Where's that bit of paper that makes it all happen? If you haven't got that bit of paper, there's no relationship, there's no action, nothing can happen. We're done, we're finished, it's all over, goodbye.
Okay, just to return to the notice of discovery for a moment, is there any special way it needs to be signed? Is it good enough to put your name on it, or do you need somebody to look at it, or what?
It's always a good idea to get people to proofread stuff, and I do that even with the legal documents I've written. I've written over 800 to 1,000 now for various people for various things. I always get people to proofread because the danger is when you read what you write, you think you're reading what you've written. You're not reading what you've written.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing, so if other people do it, they spot spelling mistakes or maybe, you know, some apostrophes in the wrong place. Because I'm aiming exact when I write these things. I'm absolutely specific. In fact, the less you write, the more you get done. That's why it's simple.
Exactitude with our words is, I think, one of the big lessons that we're all realising, just how dangerous sloppiness can be.
I'm learning to speak statutory jurisdiction, to know what the words mean to them, what understanding means, what a mutual understanding is, what liability is, what relationship is, what contract is, all that sort of thing. What is a signature? A signature is a statutory article. It's knowing what they mean by their words. And it's why when the police arrest you, they keep going, do you understand, do you understand, do you understand, do you understand? Because if you say yes, that's it. You're admitting you're entering their jurisdiction as an officer.
I know you recommended when we were talking originally a book, which is a good introduction to all of this sort of stuff. Can you recall what that was? It was only a slim little thing.
Oh, no, the thing I showed you is not an introduction. That's something you want to dive into later. You can have a go at it early on if you want to. It's Learning the Law, and it's by Glanville Williams. Glanville Williams is a QC. He's got a doctorate in law and is a fellow of the Barristers Association. He was Rouse Ball Professor of English Law in the University of Cambridge. So that's Learning the Law, Glanville Williams. And if people are into it, I'm just looking for an ISBN number, but he doesn't have one. No, he doesn't have one. I don't believe that. I thought we all did these. No, I haven't got an ISBN number, which is peculiar, because if you actually quote from books in a courtroom, by the way, it has to be the latest edition, and you have to have the ISBN number.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So say, like Guy Taylor goes on about, Halesbury's. You know, there is no authority for administrative courts in this country, nor can any act be passed to legitimise them. Well, that's the end of commercial courts then. They can't exist here. And the reason is, it's a Protestant country. We threw papacy out in 1688.
Did we? Good God, nobody, yep. Nobody told the Pope.
Yeah, I know. Nobody told the government either.
I still remember the bit in Shakespeare's King John when John actually hands the crown to a papal legate who then rents it back.
Yes.
To King John. I don't think it's a beauty. It's a really amazing couple of lines. It all happens there, right in front of your eyes on the stage.
I don't know if you remember Little Things. This is how they rub our noses in it. You remember Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory?
Yeah.
What happened when they went into the factory, the people, the children had been chosen, they had to sign something. Do you remember? It was all over the wall. And one of the little girls said, oh, I can't read the words down here. And he goes, oh, don't worry, it's just some legal stuff, and looks around in the air and gets them all to sign it without doing due diligence. And, you know, it's little things like that you pick up. I think, fuck me. Yes Minister is worth listening to for the same reason. They talk about trusts.
Yeah, Yes Minister, I think, is a real education. We've got a bunch of people who are laying on you a bunch of requirements. Let's just say that somebody didn't read the terms and conditions, and that had there been a contract, then these documents would have been requirable, because it said in there, we can ask for these at any time, which I'm not sure is actually a legal term for a contract, but let's ignore that for the moment. What it means is they put you to a whole load of grief and suffering and difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Using letters that would disappear were you to end up with them in one of these commercial courts. So where does that leave you with all of the pain in the Harris? And, you know, the thing is that technically speaking, there's kind of 30 days allowed for that. But if you don't receive all the letters in time, you might well find yourself with only a day or so to get all of your documents updated to the current address and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Making it really practically impossible for you to do it. And then you get a black mark against your name because you've been refused insurance. And yet it's all been done using bits of paper with no signature on them.
Correct. The pivotal thing, I think, in your story is money changed hands and a contract arrived. That's Closio. In other words, only what's on that bit of paper applies for the following year. If they then start sticking extra conditions on, they're not playing that contract. That contract's closed. We've closed the business.
I think that let's just say that that those were there. Let's just say it said in there, we can ask you to show us anything we want between now and the end. And so in
theory, if you signed it, you've agreed.
Yeah.
What due diligence is for? What are you?
But you haven't signed it. I'm going to get to that in a minute. The point is that at the moment they've been making you do all this stuff without signed paperwork. I mean, and then, well, let's do it. Let's just say that actually there's no contract either. But that seems to me to be a double whammy, because you've been kind of made to think that you have to do all of this stuff by bits of paper. But if you don't do it, they will void your insurance. And this doesn't seem right to me.
I understand what you're saying completely, or comprehend, should I say, rather than understand. It depends how it plays itself out, because another aspect of law is chronology. What happened when? What order did things play out in? How did the conversation go ahead? And it's why all companies record their telephone calls. Somebody was refused insurance around here because they said that an individual had no claims bonus at less than a year old, and it was a year and a half, and they used the recording to prove that was true, and in fact they'd been misinformed, so the insurance was voided. Now that was actually a legitimate legal point, so nothing could be done about it because it was recorded to be said. So it was a communication. We write or talk, we don't do it in any other way. In a courtroom, you're just playing law at high speed. On paper, you're doing it at low speed.
I had an individual at one of these call centres tell me that it's illegal to record him without us telling him. I don't believe he's quite correct on that, is he?
He's not correct at all. He's assuming that you're in statutory jurisdiction, as the entitled person have to ask for permission. If you're coming in common law wanting to make a statutory contract, you can record him until such time as you make that contract. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. We can record the police. I've got chief constables and the head of ACPO stating that that's true. Mm-hmm. If they are, you know, when they erase data as well, that's always funny when they get phones and, you know, you videoed them and they scrub it out. Basically, we're against a system that's becoming more and more corrupt. There are four stages to an empire and we're entering the chaos stage, the last one.
Indeed. So on our notice of discovery, I do think we have to have a couple of other signatures than our own, don't we? Or is that just
You want to sign it as the author and have two other people bear witness to the fact that it was created. You can, I've never done it, but if you needed to, you could call them into court and go, yeah, I signed that on the day he signed it when he wrote it and showed it me, and he did send it. And you've got the proof of sending, because if you send through the post with recorded delivery, it's about £2 for most legal documents, unless they're pages and pages. You have the proof of who it was sent to, and that it's proof of arrival. If you want, under Acts, it's the, what's it called? It's under one of the Acts where it says that that is the case, and I've got it somewhere. It'll come to me in a minute.
Is that the miscellaneous provisions one?
No, it's the Interpretations Act. Sorry, Interpretations Act. I'll get my acts up. What? I'll get my acts up. I've got them here. Hang on. I keep some acts because I've found useful bits in them that we can throw at them. That's why I've kept the sort of miscellany of things I've got. Interpretations Act. Yeah, here we go. Postage as a serving. Interpretation Act 1978, Section 7. Where an act authorises or requires any document to be served by post, whether the expression serve, inverted commas, or the expression give or send, or any other expression is used, then unless the contrary intention appears, the service is deemed to be effected by properly addressing, prepaying, and posting a letter containing the document, unless the contrary is proven. In other words, if you've got that receipt, the opponent can't say that he didn't get it. That's what you're proving. You're using the post office as a third party that somebody else got something you sent.
Yeah.
It's all that true.
And that's recorded, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. £2 usually. It's about £2.5p now, I think, for an A4 envelope with a notice in. I don't fold mine up and I print it on 100 gram paper. I let them know that I'm serious.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I completely concur with that. So what we've got there is we've got somebody who's been requiring us to do a whole load of stuff using paperwork with no signature, which is not admissible as evidence of any sort. And if we send them this notice of discovery, they are required by their own rules to provide us with the paperwork or they have a bit of a problem, don't they? Because basically what they do as part of this scam is, because they've given you 30 days nominally to give them all of the documentation, they charge you for 30 days insurance, which technically without a contract they haven't sold you, or am I misleading myself?
No, if you haven't signed anything, nothing's been sold yet. Now, so, be careful. Hang on, I'm going to pull it up. Because remember, we only communicate in writing and with words, and they record their calls. So if they say, we need you to get A, B, C, D, and E within the next 20 days, and you agree, they're negotiating. And you've agreed to the negotiation. Yes, I will get this stuff for you if you want it for me to have insurance from you for this amount. Mm-hmm. There's the negotiation stage. They're asking for shit. But it depends what time they do that. They can't do it after the contracts have been exchanged and paid for. They have to do it before.
Yeah, except that, like I say, you know, I suspect that in this case there probably was a term and condition buried in there which said we reserve the right to require you or request you to show us all of this stuff else we'll
yeah, but the problem is, what you want to do with your own insurance company is, if that's the case, is chase the contract that sold the liability.
Yes, that's right. I think that's exactly the way to go. And the thing is that with the things that you outlined earlier, so with all insurance, with land, with property, and with contracts of guarantee, this sort of thing applies. If there isn't, if both parties haven't got a contract with signatures from both parties, then the agreement think you've done and paid for hasn't actually occurred.
It doesn't exist in law. Mm. It doesn't exist in law.
Well, that's pretty crucial, isn't it, really?
Yeah. That's where fraudulent practice comes in, because a number of insurance companies are doing this. They know that if push comes to shove and they haven't sold the contract, but they've convinced the individual that they're insured, and they send them this thing to say, you're now insured, and, you know, here's what we're going to cover you for, and they get a booklet of what they're covered for. But there's no signatures in the booklet, but they think they're covered for it. Life goes on. Everyone's happy. The insurance company get the money. The individual thinks they're insured. Now, if that comes to a bang where the insurance company don't want to make themselves liable for it, they can undo that instantly. Because if you can't provide a contract, then no insurance was sold. So they just give you the money back that you paid. And you've still got a buggered car, or you've got somebody else's buggered car that has claimed against you, because you are liable. We're back to that word again.
Lee's put an interesting comment into the chat box, which says, under the Postal Services Act, a document is deemed delivered when it enters the postbox.
Yeah, but it's proving it. It's one thing to have an act that says something. It's another thing that when you go into a courtroom, you can prove what you say has happened as fact. You have to have evidence, witnesses, or both. And it's why I record my calls. I have a beautiful little... it's a self-attenuating digital recorder. I've taken it into courtrooms. I've used it on phone calls where I've put open mics so it can record that entire conversation. And I've caught people red-handed doing that. Why? Because the evidence is there that they did say what they said, because we can hear them bloody saying it. You have to be able to prove it.
Yeah, I've got one of those.
If you remember years ago, proof of postage is not proof of receipt.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, but proof, and that's why, by registered post is.
That's right. And that's why, of course, that phrase, a document is deemed delivered, is important, because deemed delivered is not the same thing as delivered, because it wouldn't say absolutely deemed if it was.
In other words, we're taking it into some sort of assumption that it did happen, but we've got no evidence that it did. But let's just say that it did.
No, I prefer the recorded post myself. We had a question from Peanut earlier in the show. Thanks for your patience, Peanut, saying, what's the difference between a notice of discovery and subject acquisition request?
Oh, subject access request. Well, access, that's big work. It's 40 days your opponent has to assemble all, and they might actually apply for an extension depending on how much you ask them for. And I think it costs £10. I haven't done one forever. I can't remember. But what you're basically doing is demanding that every single piece of paper in relation to yourself and another party is made available to you. I've only done it once with the DWP, and I ended up with something that was about 2 inches thick. And I was only looking for one bit of paper, but I knew what I was looking for. So although it was a needle in a haystack, I knew that needle was in there, and that was the only bit I wanted. Again, it was proof. I wanted that bit of paper as proof of something.
Well, I think that one of the things you said when we were talking about this was that we do this kind of notice of discovery, then the notice of default, which establishes a mutual understanding. Mm-hmm. At that point, I assume you can send other notices asking other questions. But what are you basically going to do as a... as a result of that kind of process? What happens next once they've shown that they haven't got the contract or whatever, the instrument of authority in other cases? What occurs next?
Oh, it depends what it is you're pursuing, really. I mean, if somebody's trying to get money out of you, as far as I'm concerned, if I've written documents and they still carry on sending retarded stuff with no signatures, it's a cease and desist order, and I'll write that up and send it myself. If other documents then arrive, I might go to a courtroom and ask for a cease and desist order to be made by a judge under CPR Rule 332, which is the court, under its own initiative, can make an order without a court case. And if the evidence is overwhelming, they'll do it. In other words, they'll tell the other party, stop sending paperwork to this individual. They can prove there's no relationship.
And that's, once again, because you've proved the argument to start with.
Bingo. Don't enter a courtroom until you've won the case out of court and you can prove the points you need to prove. We're getting up for, 53 minutes now. I'm sure when you're taking a break, but at some point, let me take you through a notice of clarification and understanding, because if you know how to use these, you can destroy your opponent. But we'll do that probably in the second half, but I'll make a note to do that.
Well, I think that's a cliffhanger, isn't it? That's a cliffhanger, because what we can do is we'll play 8 minutes or so of music to give everybody a bit of a break, because there's lots of information there. And if we'll come back, one of several lethal notices I know that you've got up your sleeve, we'll come back with... with Roger Walker, who I mistakenly called Roger Stewart. I'm sorry for that, Roger, in the blog.
No worries.
And we'll be talking about the clarification, a notice of clarification and understanding, and we'll be getting on to the council tax thing as well.
Yes.
So you're, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com, and we're talking with Roger Walker about notices and absence of contracts and all that sort of stuff. And here's Annie Lennox and A Whiter Shade of Pale, real beautiful version of it. And it's basically what happened to me several times whilst I was looking into all of this insurance nonsense. I don't mind telling you. We'll be back with you in 8 minutes or so. Thanks for being there, folks. Georgia Satellites and I don't know, good times, bad times, I don't know. Well, generally by definition, it's the same. It's both at the same time, isn't it? And before that, see, there was a bit of a discussion in the chat box there about Annie Lennox's Whiter Shade of Pale. I knew I was cutting it a bit fine there, folks, but you'll have noticed I've never actually played the original. I really like the song, but Procol Harum, I tend to play, what's that other one? Pandora's Box. Anyway, that was Annie Lennox's version. And now we're back in the real world with Roger Walker, and we're talking about contracts and courts and proving your case. You're still with us there, Roger?
I am indeed. I hope I'm coming through anyway.
Yep, it's all looking good this end. I think I've pressed all the right buttons. Nobody's complaining in the chat box. So let's just, we were chatting offline there a little bit. Let's just return quickly to this subject access request, because it can be quite a useful tool a bit later in the process, can't it?
That's the crack. You don't want to fire off all your shots at once. And most people, when they started this law arc, were sort of going, you're a bastard, you know, you've done this, you've done that, I've got this law that proves this. And they write screeds and pages and pages and pages, which are all to no effect. The thing with the subject access request, it's so powerful. Think you're playing poker and lead with your twos and threes and fours. if you have a conversation with your opponent, sometimes that opponent can be so retarded they actually dig their own grave. So carry on talking to them, a bit like Chris Evert on the baseline, just keep knocking the ball back. If you know that they buggered it up big time in the conversation you're having with them over time with notices, then go for the subject access request, because you could find evidence in there that proves that they've contradicted themselves or lied on the previous notices, and that your understanding was as you said it was and not as they said it was.
You're going to get a result there quite a lot, aren't you? Because that's one of the things Simon Spaniard shows time and time again, is that most staff don't actually know what they're doing.
No, almost nobody knows what they're doing. But John Cleese has put it really beautifully, because he's a bogus professor of psychology, and he has actually narrated the Tibetan Book of of Living and Dying for Sogyal Rinpoche, because he's also a Buddhist. He says it's not that people don't know what they're doing, it's that they have no idea that they don't know what they're doing. In other words, the people who are good at things are good at things because they know how bad they are at them, but they don't chastise themselves. They just go through a learning curve. But those people who aren't good at what they're doing aren't good at what they're doing because they don't know they're not good at what they're doing, so they never improve. They just do the same day over and over again. It's like they're stuck in their own little hamster wheel going round and round.
Don Rumsfeld called the unknown unknowns.
There are known knowns, there are known unknowns, there are unknown knowns, and there are unknown unknowns.
I thought actually that was a rare moment of clarity for him in all fairness. Anyway, let's. You were threatening to talk to us about a particularly useful club that you've been wielding called a notice of clarification and understanding. What is it that particularly excites you about that one, then?
Right, we need to have a little bit of lesson in logic as well. Given that law is about relationship, the notice of clarification and understanding, sorry, not discovery, clarification and understanding, literally just has to be headed up. I did one to the Chief Constable of the West Midlands Police for fun. And in fact, I followed it up with five other documents. And the notice of clarification and understanding was this: my address top right, police's address top left. Dear, I can't remember what his name was at the time because it's changed now. Dear Mr. Chief Constable, I, Roger Walker, a man under common law, would like you to clarify an understanding I have within the next 14 days. And you put clarification underneath the heading of notice of clarification and understanding, and that's your clarification. I want this clarifying in 14 days. Underneath that, capital letters, underlined, understanding. Insofar as it is my understanding, there is no law legislation at this time that allows any police officer to commit common law offences whilst acting in the capacity of a police officer, regardless of any rank or hierarchical position. I obviously address you, Chief Constable, because you never operate as an officer. I look forward to you clarifying my understanding within the next 14 days of the relationship I have with you and your organisation.
Of course, so the Chief Constable's always a constable.
Yes, he's never the Chief Officer. Let me explain why I do what I do. I am actually defining what I think the relationship is, and he has to prove that my relationship with him isn't as I describe it. So I'm asking him, with article of law, to clarify an understanding I have. In other words, am I right or not? And indeed, in the notice I put, if you fail to prove my understanding to be incorrect, it will by definition be correct. And he didn't respond, so we're back off.
I'm not surprised. He's probably still bloody thinking about it, mate.
Oh, he got better. Anyway, following up what we said on the first half, I got no response. So I closed it down with, obviously, a default notice and mutual understanding that the relationship I described I have with every single police officer in the West Midlands Police is as I described it. In other words, if they commit common law offences against me, I have a right of claim against them because they're assuming jurisdiction. They haven't proven it yet.
Which is another important word to look at. It isn't really. Assuming and presumption are what it's all based on, really.
All statutory law is.
And basically, it's our recognition of that is possibly one of the most important recognitions we can have.
Mm. I mean, I can't think of the name in Canada. Mark something. A Canadian guy who does this, and he puts some videos up.
Mark Stevens.
That's him. He had an interesting conversation, which you highlighted and I'd seen before. And he's not the only one who's had that conversation. And it was with a professor of law. And the conversation comes down to the absolute nitty gritty. Can you prove I'm operating in that in that jurisdiction? The answer is no. It's assumed by the court that it's an operation the moment everybody assembles in the courtroom.
I just love that conversation. I love the way Mark kind of really corners him. I think Mark's been on Unique Lee's show, actually, The Dark Side of the Room on Raconteurs News.
He's very good, but he's good with language, you see. He's looked at language and he understands what they're saying and what it means and what it doesn't mean and how to talk to them in their own jurisdiction.
And actually, he demonstrates another thing that we're talking about tonight, which is the art of questioning your opponent into a corner. He is extremely good at that. And, you know, if you want to, I'd say that if you don't have much idea or can't envision the kind of letters and notices we're talking about, if you watch Mark interviewing people when he's on a good night, he is extremely good at nailing the big question, isn't
yes.
he? But he does that by harrying them, by asking them three or four questions that are related and not necessarily clearly going where he wants to go.
Well, do you remember the Michael Howard interview by Jeremy Paxman, where Michael Howard failed to answer the same question 14 times?
I remember that.
Lawyers do. They're slimy. If you're asking a question and they don't want you to have the answer yes, they'll do anything other than say the word yes.
So they'll
throw a tantrum. They'll call an adjournment. They'll do something that means they don't say yes.
So what a skilled interlocutor will do, will actually ask the question in four apparently unrelated parts to get the various bit, because that's what Mark Stevens does.
You're putting a jigsaw piece together.
And then you can repeat those answers back to the individual and ask that killer question.
Absolutely, that's the one. When you go into a courtroom, you must prepare Q&A. You know what your case is and you know why you're going in there. You've proven there isn't a contract out of court, therefore you're kicking, somebody into touch who's coming to try and take money off you. So you've proven that out of court, and you've gone into court to say, okay, or if they take you to court, you've gone in there saying, no, I've already had this conversation. Here's my bundle, Judge, which was submitted to the courtroom, blah, 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 blah. Here's the conversation. Here's what we had. Here's the proof that what I say is true. And, you know, you'll still get judges looking for the other party because the whole system's gone bent.
Yeah.
But the notice of clarification and understanding, what you're doing is you're turning the tables through 180 degrees. You're asking your opponent to prove that you're wrong. You're not trying to prove to your opponent that you're right. Can you? That's a tricky sort of perspective for some people to get. But if you get it, you can make a notice of a clarification and understanding absolutely devastating if you know what the relationship is, because if you know that they can't disprove it. So you ask them the killer question, knowing that there's no legislation they can come back with that says you're wrong. That immediately strikes a relationship that you've proven in law exists.
Mm.
In other words, you come and physically violate my body as a police officer, your people will be going to prison.
And that works to keep them off your drive, does it?
It does. We had two police officers in North Yorkshire who were backed up against the wall, and we did it. We used notices of discovery, notices of clarification and understanding only. We didn't tell them that we knew anything about law. We didn't tell them we didn't accuse them of anything. We just sent in a video of an incident with crimes that were committed at certain times during that video, and it was a complete stealth operation. We got them to play to us. In other words, take control of the conversation, them do the work. It's like playing tennis. You want to control the court, move your opponent around. Don't have them controlling the court, moving you around. So we fired off loads of documents very quickly to back them into a corner, and they realized, we had a mediation meeting where they realized we could put them in prison.
So you went undercover right in front of them,
in a way. Yeah,
you pretended to be something you weren't, which I think is another really important part of the game. If you can do a bit of that, it's great. Some friends of mine have got a guy who was actually ordained, and whenever it's necessary to deal with people wearing Masonic regalia and stuff who are presenting themselves impersonally at the gates, and there's any paperwork to be done, they send the vicar out to do it.
Mm.
It works really well.
The vicars have a high role in law. Remember that notaries are created by the Archbishop of Canterbury in a special court where they take an oath. And the oath is supposed to uphold the law regardless of the parties. But there, because of what happened some years ago when Rusty tried to get a judge arrested, the notaries met up and agreed they wouldn't sign any notarial documents against the government. In other words, they're all in breach of their oath. But they're working for the Catholic Church anyway.
And I noticed you did mention getting something notarised. That's a Jesse, you found at least one friendly notary, have you?
We've got more than one. There are a few who will. We sort of hunted around.
Yeah. Well, that's a good sign, isn't it? Because, I mean, one of the things I really do expect to see out of all of this is eventually there's got to be some sort of breakout in the legal system, because they can't all be happy with the way it's running.
Well, you can run an out-of-court settlement. That's the crack. If you put the documents through a notary, then you can, when you send your notices, rather than sending them to your opponent, this is costly, though, because you might have a long conversation. And if it's like 25, we've got a notary that charges 25 quid, one that charges 50. I've met one that charges 85 a notice. Mm-hmm. It depends. Look around, shop around. But okay. If you're going to have a chat with your adversary, you may submit quite a few notices. If you submit 10, that's 250 quid. Might be 500, could be 850. So you've got to be careful that you know you're going to win if you're going to use a notary. The way around that is to play the documents out, win the case out of court on the documents, and then resubmit the whole lot through a notary and see what happens when they get the first one back again from a notary. Because the notary's involved, they're going to shit themselves because there's no court can overturn the decision.
Okay, let's move on. We've got a couple of interesting queries from the chat box here. We've got one from Nick Nomic. Hi, Nick. Nice to see you in there, matey. It says, if a tribunal issued a court order requiring DWP to supply documents, legal arguments and future attendance, but DWP then make a more favourable decision, can Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunal Service clerk then lapse, or the chat box is really moving quick at the moment, then lapse an adjourned appeal. I can read that to you again if you like.
I'm not sure what they're trying to get out there. You can certainly ask the DWP for disclosure, and I've done that historically for a number of people. What you get is stuff that's unsigned. So you send it back going, thanks for your communication dated to so-and-so. Can you please send us back a copy with a signature on it? Someone takes liability for the action being taken. And that's when they crap themselves, because you get more coming back with no signatures and you keep demanding them.
And can you insist that they refer to you by your proper moniker rather than by their capitalised name?
No, you can't, because if you're with the DWP, you are the statutory entity, you are the entitled person.
Right.
Okay. You're operating in that jurisdiction.
Yep, and here's another one from Unique Lee. Here's one. Doc, being ordained and being an ordinary, you should take a look into mandates when looking at this from an ecclesiastical perspective. Would your guest have a comment on this?
Indeed, it's what was going on about with the Archbishop of Canterbury and notaries. The notaries are Catholic. The Archbishop of Canterbury creates treason every time he actually creates one, and he's the second in command in law. Ecclesiastes... if you've got ecclesiastic, what a layman means in a courtroom is you're not a member of the cloth, you're not a vicar you're not ecclesiastically ordained. And it does have significance. If you remember, there was a guy in London, I can't remember his name, I can see his face. He was a judge who got a woman off a council tax purely and simply because he'd realised that the fees they were putting on of £80 per letter and movement and all those bollocks were actually already legislated for, and it couldn't be any more than 20. So the whole claim was legitimate. He got it thrown out.
I remember, and then there was a subsequent ruling which actually overturned the liability orders along with that.
It was Haringey Council, which, funnily enough, is where Baby P and who was the other poor soul that got killed? Victoria Clembier. That's Haringey Council. It's the same bloody council. And they had independent auditors come in to check all the council tax.
Where did they find an independent auditor then?
Well, yeah, okay. Supposedly, then, they had an independent auditor. But, I mean, the fact that somebody came in and started stirring it up must have tightened a few arseholes, I think.
Okay, so let's have a quick...
But yeah, if you go as a vicar, if you go in as ordained, that does actually give you a lot more weight in law, a huge amount of weight.
Yes, indeed. Yes, it's something that I'm starting to look into myself. I quite fancy the Reverend Rocks radio show. What do you think?
Well, I'm actually an ordained Buddhist, but whether I can use it in our jurisdictional law, I don't think I can. I've used my name before to be able to go into court knowing that they haven't got title over it, so they don't have jurisdiction over me, even though I'm in their environment. And as I explain to them, I say, think of me as an Englishman in France talking French to a Frenchman, but I'm still not French. Yes, I'm in a statutory court talking to statutory individuals in their statutory language, but I'm a common law man because you don't have any jurisdiction over me yet.
It's sharp, that.
Yeah, I'm an Englishman in France talking French to a Frenchman, but I'm still bloody English.
So what about the council tax or community charge or whatever we want to call it? How does what we've been talking about apply to that?
It depends where you want to start. Where it's usually I've intervened with people is when they've got letters from bailiffs, and obviously they go, oh my God, you know, they're coming around to seize things. Now, let's go back to what we said at the start. It's all about paperwork and it's all about relationship. Party A and Party B have a relationship if there is a contract with a set of terms and conditions. The other form of statutory relationship is Party A can only act on Party B if they have an instrument of authority from a court to allow them to act. Now then, so what do we do? Okay, we want to look for a very, very specific piece of paper. So you send to the CEO of that bailiff company a notice of discovery for the instrument of authority to act. That could be a liability order, a possession order, something, the instrument of authority. And you ask for it within 12 days, 14 days, a reasonable period of time. They then come back and say something stupid over pages that doesn't actually answer anything. So, in other words, you've got to know when you're getting noise back that you don't need to respond to. If you've asked for something, one document, and anything other than that document comes back, they haven't answered the discovery notice. They're talking about something, but they're not giving you what you asked for. So you've got a three-page screed, and there's no warrant from the court. Right, now you default them. Thanks for your response on such a date, or no response at all. We now have it as a mutual understanding that you have no instrument. I'm now going to give you, as an opportunity, another 7 days to email, fax, or send by any other description or as well as post any copy you have that you can submit. If it's electronic, then send it as an attachment to the following email address, because they wander around with iPads. Now, nothing happens. So, okay, we've proved the bailiff doesn't have an instrument. Right, who else got involved? Well, the court gave the instrument to somebody at a council for the bailiff to come to collect things for council tax. Right, write to the clerk of the court. Again, do it under a name. Find out what their name is. So it'll be Mr. Joe Bloggs acting as the clerk to the court for whichever court. Apparently, you sent whatever the instrument of authority was, liability order or whatever, to somebody at such and such a council that has now caused an enactment by a bailiff. Can you please send me a copy of this instrument within the next 12 days? They usually write back and go, sorry, we don't keep
copies.
Right. So what do you do then is you send up a follow-up document. This is what I mean by leaving the SARS request till later. Get them to dig their own grave. Yeah. Now, the next notice is, many thanks for your response and telling me that you don't keep copies. I'm now giving you 7 days to tell me who you gave the original to, their name, the capacity they act in for the city council. In other words, you're asking the clerk to dob in the individual who brought the action.
Now, they don't like batting against the home team, do they?
Bingo. So guess what happens? Nothing. You then give another, you close on that document then with a default document and a mutual understanding that the clerk never issued anything, the courts never issued any instrument to allow such and such a council to act on behalf of somebody referred to as the entitled person's name, Mr. Joe Bloggs. That's fine. We're done. Now what you do is you go back to the council, but now you've got the proof that the bailiff and the court never had them. So you send copies of that to prove that you've had the conversation that proves that they haven't got it. And since they're the only party left in the instigating party, you give the Section 151 officer 14 days to send you that instrument under threat of imprisonment for 7 years by attempting to fly under the authority of a court without an instrument.
That's brilliant, because you've managed to corner a fourth party by questioning a second and a third party. I like that one.
Well, no, you're cornering the initiating party, which is the council, by proving that the court who got involved to get what should have been a bit of paper, again, we're looking for this magic bit of paper, the instrument of authority to act to the council, so that they could employ a bailiff and go and get this for us. So the three parties involved are the council, the courts and the bailiff, and you are party B to their party A. Party A is the council. Two conspiratorial entities have come in to help them.
Mm-hmm.
Now then, I'm going to give you, because I've got them up in front of me now, where this 7 years imprisonment comes from, because it's well worth having and throwing at your Section 151 officer, because it will make them crap themselves. Let's talk about, I'm trying to find it amongst the whole screw here whilst thinking of other things.
Damn, I would imagine that this must be something you've dealt with in real life quite often, isn't it?
Yes, I am at the moment, actually, but I can't talk about it because of where it is. Not to worry. Let's go back to council tax. Council tax is voluntary. The reason being is you have to apply for it. So if you move to another area, you would be sent an application form for council tax. You then sign that. Guess what? You've just created a contract and a relationship between you and your council by doing so.
Your signature is valuable.
Bingo. So let's go back to the four stages of contract. Well, this council's offered you a contract that says we want to take money off you to provide services that we have to, whether you pay us or not. So due diligence, do I really want to part with this money for services they have to provide, whether we pay them or not? No, I don't. Straight to closure. You can send them a formal letter back saying you don't wish to this year. Now, it can't be compulsory, and we're back to looking for things that aren't there. Let me explain what I mean. If you get any of the Local Government and Finance Acts, and you get an Adobe copy of them, and you click Edit and Search, put in the words or the prefixes to the words compulsory, obligatory, or mandatory. If they don't turn up, it can't be any of them. And in the Tax Act 2007, I did this in front of a judge, and I proved within less than a minute in a 774-page document that the computer could go and find the words obligatory, mandatory, or compulsory. And it found obligatory, but it was under what other parties had to do, not the entitled person. It certainly wasn't mandatory, and it certainly wasn't compulsory.
Well,
the word would be there.
Isn't this completely bizarre? Because we've also really established that is definitely the case with income tax. There is absolutely no obligation for any man, woman, or even a person to pay income tax. We're saying the same thing. Saying the same thing about the community charge, and we're saying that the insurers are not issuing insurance policies. It's getting to look a bit like smoke and mirrors, mate.
That's basically all it is, really. I mean, a lot of the judges will try and baffle you by talking bollocks for like 3.5 minutes or 4 minutes. And it's really off subject. And if you listen to them carefully, they're talking a lot, but they're not really saying anything. And I've done it before now and gone, is that it? What was the relevance of that? We're still back to point A. They will also try and move you in the courtroom and want you to discuss other things than what you want to discuss. That's what moving the court means. It's moving the focus of attention of what we're going to talk about.
It's really important that you maintain your focus on the reason you're there, just the same as it's important that you maintain exactly the same focus in the written work, actually.
Correct. Absolutely all the way. And use few words. Say what you need to and stop. Ask questions. Remember the six Socratic questions. That's what you're going to be looking for. Who, how, where, what, when, and why. If you got answers to those, we're back to Mark Stevens. That's what he's good at, Socratic questioning. He really nails people to the floor. So how you ask a question can get your opponent to kill themselves.
And on that note, I really would like to recommend the wooden book, which is called The Trivium, which is logic, rhetoric, and grammar. But it's also got books on ethics and poetic meter, and it's devastating. I heard about it a long time ago. It's six wooden books, all clad as one, and it will teach you loads and loads and loads of really good quotes and about how to use the language and how to structure it in such a way as to make a good argument, which I guess must be part and parcel of what you're doing.
It's structuring language correctly in a way that you get things done with language. The Trivium itself is grammar, logic, rhetoric.
Yeah.
So you've got to know, it's all there, really, if you look at it. If you can't write or talk a reasoned argument to a conclusion where the opponent cannot come up with an argument that defeats it, you're going nowhere. You're just making noise.
Do you think there's any... it'd be a good idea for us to practice some of these old debating skills. The reason why this was brought to mind was because you mentioned Socratic questioning. The kind of thing we're talking about is actually a kind of a recognised classical art, isn't it, that we're bringing back to life?
Absolutely. It's the art of acerbic logic proving a point with evidence where nobody could look at it and see it as anything other than that which it's described. Similarly, when you write documents, legal documents, have no ambiguity at all. Make sure it can't be interpreted in any other way than you say. Because it's a wiggle room, they can get out of it.
Yeah, which of course they're extremely good at. I mean, the point is, I guess, that because by and large, my approach is to stay out of their jurisdiction under all and as many circumstances as possible.
Fair play.
But I guess what we're talking about here is the fact that they are now bending or breaking their own rules so badly, and they're the ones to whom the rules apply. We are
correct.
Not. So yes. We are effectively suggesting that we can safely and effectively start using their own tools against them.
Absolutely, but you have to know something about law to know that they've broken them. By the way, I've just found that thing. It's the County Courts Act 1984, Section 135. Any person who delivers or causes to be delivered to any other person any paper falsely purporting to be a copy of any summons or other process of a county court, knowing it to be false, or B, acts or professes to act under false colour or pretense of the process of authority of a court, shall be guilty of an offence and shall be liable on conviction, on indictment, to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 7 years. In other words, if that Section 151 officer hasn't got an instrument that proves you created a liability on paper that means you owe council tax, they're committing a crime.
Okay, and I'd like to chuck in at this point. I've been talking with Pete Kroll on the subject of contracts and the like, and he'll be on the show in the not-too-distant, I think. And this is the one that we hear quoted a lot, the Law of Property Miscellaneous Provisions Act, which, although it's to do with property, Pete sent me several judges' rulings which are nothing to do with property but are quoting these two bits of this particular act, which is from 1989, and Section 2.1 under contracts for sale, etc., say a contract for the sale or other disposition of an interest in land can only be made in writing and only by incorporating all the terms which the parties have expressly agreed in one document or where contracts are exchanged in each. And number 3, 2.3 says the document incorporating the terms or where contracts are exchanged, one of the documents incorporating them, but not necessarily the same one, must be signed by or on behalf of each party to the contract, which is exactly what we've been saying, isn't it?
Absolutely. Same for insurance, same for contracts of guarantee.
Hey, there you go. Well, we've got a couple of questions in the chat box. One's from Lee, and it's a pretty quick one, I think, and that's, is it correct that two witnesses adequate for making a document lawful? I think you
correct.
And it's for making it deliverable, isn't it? It shows that it's been served. That's it, servable.
Years ago, I went to a magistrate's court and I had a long conversation. We batted the court date 3.5 months ahead, which allowed me to have a long conversation over time before we got into court with all of those documents finding their way into the court file. We had it adjourned again, believe it or not, and when I was there, I only wanted to satisfy one thing at the adjournment because they wanted to run another case and not ours. I turned to the clerk of the court and I said, "Clerk, are all the documents that I've submitted on behalf of, I won't say what his name was, are they legitimate and admissible into this courtroom?" And he looked at me and smiled and went, "Yes." And I recorded that because, again, we're proving it. Okay, so I had a little recorder. I didn't tell them I was recording.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that does occur to me is that that all of this is taking a lot of time and effort, the crafting of all these notices and that sort of stuff. Is there any way that we ever get to see any kind of remuneration for this?
Yes, you can charge. They can't ask an entitled person in statutory jurisdiction to do work without payment. Now, don't come up with silly figures. I mean, some people got mauled in court for sort of, you know, £500 million lines and all this sort of, you know, make it sensible. If you sent a letter, charge them £20 for your time of constructing it, the ink, the paper, the sending it, blah, 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 and the inconvenience. When you actually are a litigant in person, just so you know, at the end of a court case, if you've won, the judge turns to you and just goes, "Anything else?" And what they're actually saying is, "Do you have any expenses?" Now, again, we're back to paperwork. So I audit and I submit an audit for an amount of money. And as a litigant in person, I have the evidence that you can claim for lost income from taking the time to construct the documents and run the case. In fact, they pay more in court costs to a litigant in person than they do to a solicitor, because he's doing his job.
Now, there's an interesting point, folks. You can actually put, as well as all the stuff that we've already heard Simon Spaniard talking about, which can earn you a fair amount of cash, you can actually do them for lost income. I think that's an important addition to the armoury.
It is, because what they'll do, that they won't say, have you got any costs? It's quite a thing. They'll just go, it'll be over and say, yeah, well, obviously he doesn't have to pay, so I fined for the defendant. And he will then turn to you and go, anything else? And that, and you'll go, well, we've won, so no, thank you very much. Most people do, and that's why they do it.
So that's what you did to start with, isn't it?
Yeah, I did, but then I realised what it was they were getting up to. Mm. So when I realised it, I thought, right, I'll play the game right to the ground. I'm actually going to audit for all the notices. I'm going to put my reference numbers on that audit sheet, because all we're talking about is administration and paperwork. So he wants the proof that my claim for costs is a valid claim. Here's the audit, and I just handed it to him on a piece of paper, and it was all broken down, totaled up, and that was that.
So there you go, folks. Not only can you suggest to these people that they're required to provide you with things that you know they don't have, and we know that it's an administrative system, they need to be held to account, and if nothing else, you'll be keeping them bloody busy by doing that. But if it all goes really, really well, and of course it doesn't always, then you can find yourself on a rain-soaked holiday in Tintagel or something like that. How brilliant's that? I mean, what happens if it goes wrong, Roger? How much trouble can you find yourself in?
This is where I have, shall we say, some misgivings with certain websites that turn up on the internet who claim they've saved an awful lot of people an awful lot of money. I've met some of the people who've come to me that they failed for. One individual in question lost nearly £250,000 house and paid £13,700 in costs. And this was due to somebody else's work. And by the time he'd got to me, I realised what had happened was they'd written documents for him. The moment he went into the courtroom, they dropped him like a stone. In other words, that's where they stop. Now, I went in the courtroom with him. The documents he'd submitted, some of them were good, but the problem was he had no court experience and I could only be his McKenzie friend. In other words, I could only advise him. I couldn't speak for him. And he didn't get it, even though we had like a day in advance. And I realised then it was pointless doing it for other people, because if they can't stand up in court and do it themselves, you'll never get rights of audience to do it for them. And if they're a tosser, they're just going to get eaten alive. It doesn't matter if the paperwork's good. If they don't know how to run the courtroom, they've had it.
I think that's a really important point. But at the same time, if you're going to do what we outlined earlier, which is basically win by questioning on paper first, you should have a pretty good handle on what's going on. But the judge, like you say, they can throw a paddy. They can chuck anything at you. How thorough can your preparations be for the unexpected in these circumstances?
Well, the unexpected can be that you've got overwhelming evidence that you're right and the judge is as bent as a nine bob nose. What you're then into the situation of doing, I haven't done this yet because I knew that it would be, I'd have to be unbelievably good to get a judge, a decision made against a judge by a judge, is you haul them along. The other thing you can do is put a lane, get a lane prepared before you even go in the courtroom for about 50,000 quid and get it signed by a notary. That could cost you 50 quid itself, but leave the name open. When the usher comes up, they will tell you the names of everybody in the courtroom. The only one you're interested in is the clerk. Get the clerk's name, Mr. Mrs. or whatever, and get that and get it ready. Don't write it on the lane because you can use it any time and you might not. You might win the case. But if it looks like it's going tits up, put their name on, walk out of where you're standing and go right up to the clerk. Don't piss around, no matter what anybody else says, and bang it down in front of him and tell him that he better control the administrator in this courtroom. In statutory law, judges are administrators. They're not judges. They're judges acting in the capacity of administrators. In the same way human beings will go to work tomorrow all over the country acting as Section 151 officers for their county, for their city council.
Acting as...
Get it? It's the job they're doing at the time. They're not a judge. They're an administrator when they're in that room. Mm. The clerk is the important one.
So the judge is sometimes acting as a 151 officer?
No. The point I'm making is that we are men and women, but we wander into statutory jurisdiction sometimes to do our job. That's the title we're under when we're doing our job. We're acting in a capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's clear. I've got another question here from Tobias Lee. He asked it a while back. Sorry to take a bit of time to get around to it, Tobias. It's slightly complex. You might want to hear it twice. It says, I have a magistrate's court summons for non-payment of council tax to answer. To answer the complaint that you are the person properly liable to pay council tax and that the sum shown below has not been paid. I'm thinking of going. How would you deal with this?
It depends when the date is, because, of course, if it's going to be very soon, you might not have enough time to start a conversation. The moment you get something like that, the word I heard in there is liable. So, again, you're looking for the instrument that created the liability.
To make you the person properly liable to pay the council tax.
Correct. Yep. In other words, they have to prove the relationship that council tax is owed because you created the liability by signing an application form for it. If they can't produce the application form, they can't bring a case against you. Now, he's not going to a magistrate's court. He's going to a court that has been hired for the day by the council. It's a kangaroo court. They might as well hire a hotel room, but they do it in a courtroom because it looks more official.
Yeah, and they like arsing about.
And if you actually get the clerk to the court, they basically rubber stamp these documents, the council. I think the courts have sold the right to the councils, or the councils buy off them to have a rubber stamp to use the clerk's name. So there's no due diligence by the clerk. Now, if you nail the clerk, they're going to be very uncomfortable if you start asking the clerk for that instrument, because they don't even get involved.
Oh, dear. There's not very much of it left intact after this simple little 2-hour show, is there, really?
Yeah.
What we're saying to Tobias basically is that the first move would be a notice of discovery, as we were talking about in the first half of the show, wouldn't it? Show me the contract. It's the thing that we've been using for years: document and verify the obligation. And this is a way.
I, Tobias, a man under common law, require and demand of you, Mr. or Mrs. Somebody, acting in the capacity of Section 151 officer for the council, send me the instrument that created the liability you say exists between yourselves and somebody referred to as Mr. the entitled person. You have 14 days from the date of this notice. You always put a time limit, because if you don't, they'll just leave it in an in tray doing nothing. You have to back them into a corner in time.
Plus the fact that they do that to us all the time. Tobias has put in there, I want to go in there and have some fun. So long as you've done the paperwork, you stand some chance of getting away with that, don't you? The thing is that this is one of the things, you see, is that it occurs to me that although they don't have the proof and they don't have a contract and all that sort of stuff, if you actually end up in court,
You're still looking for that bit of paper that created the liability. And never mind the rest of the paperwork. That's the only bit of paper I want to see in this courtroom now. Can it be made manifest, Judge? Judge, make this man show me the instrument of liability here and now. Motion, motion, motion. I want to see the instrument that created this liability. That's the only reason I'm in this room. If he hasn't got it, you're back to what I've just said, Section 135. He's flying under the auspices of acting under a court, and he hasn't got the legitimacy. You can put the bugger in prison.
He's committing perjury, isn't he, under the strictest terms?
He's wasting court time. He's bringing a fallacious case. You could submit, if you know what it is, a demurrer and say that the whole thing is farcical because you've spent hours in communication and there is no instrument of liability. You can't have a liability unless you've decided to commit to it. You have to have signed something that has a bit of paper that says, yeah, I'll pay council tax. If he's got that in the courtroom, you're dead. If he hasn't, he's dead. Get it?
Yeah.
It's either there or it isn't.
Well, there you go.
You can prove it or you can't.
Which is pretty much exactly what that Miscellaneous Provisions Act saying as well. You've either got the contract or you haven't, and they haven't. Hopefully that'll be helpful to you, Tobias. The podcast will probably be up sometime a bit later in the weekend, so you can listen to the earlier part of the show and see what the notice of discovery and notice of default and stuff are all about.
I tell you what, can you actually, I don't want to give it away to everyone. I was wanting for Tobias, I can send him copies of stuff he can use, because I've done this loads of times. I know what he's going through. You can actually build a wall to this. And the thing you're chasing is, A, what created the liability? And if a court appears to have got involved, where's the liability order? That's the other bit of paper you're interested in, because a bailiff can't act without one of those.
Okay, well, that's not a problem, Tobias. If you want to PM, you can private message me in the chat room at raconteursnews.com and send me, put your email address in there. I'll make sure it gets over to Roger, and bingo, hopefully you'll have a beautiful and productive relationship. That'd be great.
So, I hope so. I've got examples of things he can send.
Absolutely great. And I can say that Roger definitely has got examples of things you can send, because I've seen some of them, and they're absolutely great. So it's real world work. Yep. Yeah, it's actually been done and proven, hasn't it? And you know, what could be wrong? You know, they claim they've got the perfect tool, so why don't we use it to tighten their nuts?
Bingo. In the community chance thing, because you've got the council, the courts and the bailiff, once you know what their relationship is, you can play off your relationship or lack of it with any and all of them. And basically, we're back to clarification understanding. Insofar as it's my understanding, there is no instrument of authority that created any liability for somebody referred to as that means they owe a community charge to your council. Can you please clarify my understanding in the next 14 days? If you fail to do so, it means my understanding is correct and that there is no liability. The end.
That's it. And basically speaking, most of the brown envelopes that come through your door with whom you do not feel you actually have any kind of contractual obligations, this same process can be applied to.
Every time. You're looking, it's administrative law, you're looking to prove that a relationship doesn't exist. Or one does, if that's to your advantage. Depends which way around you're going.
That was absolutely...
But Tobias, I was going to say, have fun. Do have fun. Here's some of the fun you can have. If you get a letter to dear sir or madam, just send one back saying there's no one named at this address.
Yes, indeed, yeah, or dear occupier or any of that kind of stuff.
There's nobody referred to. Who do you think I am? What do you think I am, an Israelite?
Yeah, indeed, yeah, or an hermaphrodite.
Yeah, occupier. It's hidden in the language with, say, when bailiffs come and seize goods. They take possession of goods. Yeah, that's not ownership. It just means they have them.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is 9/10 of the law. And before they establish that 9/10, you've actually got that 9/10.
If you can turn it around, if the paperwork doesn't exist that gave them the right to act, they didn't have the right to act and they themselves are committing common law offences.
That's it. And also, I think it should be borne in mind that when it comes to land and property, he who fails to assert his rights has none.
Bingo. I was going to say that where I got those costs for a litigant in person, there's a great little book on the internet. It's free PDF. It's, come here, I'm just trying to get the page up. A Handbook for Litigants in Person. A Handbook for Litigants in Person. They're all QCs and highly qualified judges that have gone through this, and I'm trying to see which part of it. It's got disclosure and inspection of documents, default judgment, witness statements, the whole nine yards, but it's also got costs for self-litigant in there as well.
And costs for self-litigant, really great, mate, compared with the kind of cash that you and, because Roger Barry Kent kindly sent me a copy of that, the kind of money that you and I normally make. We could definitely probably even afford to go down to Tintagel when the sun's shining.
what you're actually after for the cost is it's CPR rule part 36, but it's how it applies to self-litigants. There's costs in there you can charge for your work.
Very good. So we're coming to the point where it's coming up to 11 o'clock, so I'm going to play some music probably through to midnight, but we've got a couple of closing questions for you, Roger. Mm-hmm. We've got from Tony, one of our hosts on Raconteurs News, and he's asking, if you start paying council tax, are you contracted until the following April?
Yes, because what you're doing is admitting there's a liability. Let me explain how this works another way around. If you've got a court coming after you, what tends to happen is they go, oh, you owe an amount of money, 150 quid. And they'll say something like, you only have to pay 75 if you do it in 14 days. Well, if you were absolutely watertight in law, wouldn't you want to get it all? So why do they go for less? Then they could send one that says, well, pay us a penny and we'll call it a day. The moment you pay that penny, you have admitted that there is a liability and they'll come and get the rest.
Because payment is performance on the contract.
Bingo.
Yeah.
You've admitted the liability. I owe something, so I'll give you this. But you're admitting you owe because you've paid something.
That's it. And that's another really important thing, because in a way, we've been saying that we either write it or we speak it. But in fact, your actions can also, they can have the same effect. They call it thoughts in action, don't they?
Yeah, well, that's why I said it's about paperwork and money.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. They're okay. Legal documents too. Money is a legal document.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, you know, in a sense.
That's all it is. Yeah. That's all it is. It's only a legal document.
Just a promise to pay, mate.
Yeah.
Just a promise to pay. Okay, well, we've got one closing question which was put in the chat box right at the beginning from Uniquely before we let you go, Roger, with much gratitude, and that is, are you a fervent supporter of the Judean People's Front, or are you a People's Front of Judea man?
I think at the end of the day, most people have gone beyond party politics. And I realised years ago in this country we do not need party politics. What we need is a lot of, shall we say, ethical, enlightened intellectuals who can go there and do the job for the rest of the people as independents, because then the banks wouldn't be able to control it, because you'd have independent people all over the place. They could vote in a government from between them, and you might have the best of us running the show instead of the worst. So I couldn't really care about political parties, sorry.
Absolutely, totally brilliant. They're fucking splitters, the lot of them. Well, it's been a total pleasure having you to chat to, Roger. I knew it would be, and I'm hoping that everybody in the chat box finding it useful. It looks like it is. There's a, oh yeah, look at that. Yeah, it's moving quite quick. There's lots of people.
It's not as difficult as you think, and you're at play. You're playing tennis, but play poker as well, in the sense of fire a few shots off to see if the instruments exist. If the instruments don't exist, you've immediately got the upper hand, and you can have a great fun with your opponent if you've got that. Then slam in your subject access request and watch them crap themselves.
Absolutely brilliant. That's really good. Thank you very much, Roger. And we will be having further chats offline on the insurance subject, and I'm sure we'll hopefully be able to cook up another show in the future if you'd be happy to come back.
If it's appropriate, yeah, it depends what people want discussed, really. That's the thing.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing. I'll keep my eye out for appropriate subjects, but in the meantime it's been really, really awesome having you on, and I think a very useful discussion. Thanks tons for all of the work you're doing and for the time to come and put it across to us.
Not at all. If I can do it, Nick, anybody can.
There you go, and I think that's an appropriate cue for Motorhead, and you can't boogie with the bogeyman. Well, according to Roger, maybe you can.
Cheers, Nick.
Eddie Cochran there, and Cut Across Shortly. And before that, You Can't Boogie with the Boogeyman by Motorhead. Well, big thanks to Roger for coming on and giving us that. I realise that there's a lot of info in there, so it'd be well worth getting to the podcast. Also, I think I know enough people who are mad enough with their insurance companies, especially their motor insurance companies, because we think, me and Roger and one or two other people, that lots and lots of people are being required to provide documents in unrealistically short spaces of time sometimes, and that they're less than happy with what's going on. Now, the thing is, if absolutely none of them have got a contract to be doing that or even requesting the documents in the first place, and if absolutely none of them are accepting the liability for which you're paying when you nominally take out this insurance policy, then what the hell is it that's going on? Absolutely bloody nothing. That's what's going on.